Brother Aaron Martin, ask the Lord's blessing upon the service to follow. Brother Aaron.
Our dear Heavenly Father, we come humbly before Thy throne of grace once again to thank Thee for the opportunity we have to gather together in convention and consider a portion of Thy word. We thank Thee for the blessings of meat that we may take from the services and ask that we would take them into our hearts and be able to apply them in our daily walks with Thee. We ask Thy special blessing upon the presentation to follow, that we may be uplifted and strengthened and grow stronger in Thee. We ask for greater measure of Thy Spirit for ourselves and for all Thy people the world over, that we may all grow stronger into Christ, and especially upon our dear sister Christy as she embarks upon this narrow way. We ask for Thy blessing upon all Thy people the world over, and for Thy will to be done, and we pray for forgiveness in our dear neighbor's name, where we've fallen short of Thy will. We come before Thee now, always seeking Thy face, in the precious name of our Savior, Jesus Christ. Amen.
Okay, so everyone sit back, relax, take any notes, write down questions, because there'll be a question and answer period afterwards, and enjoy the presentation.
Dearly beloved brethren in the Lord, it is a great blessing, a privilege, to be able to attend convention with you in this special way. We thank the Heavenly Father, we thank the Puget Sound Ecclesia for making this arrangement possible. The hour before us will be in the form of an audio-visual presentation. We would ask you to please take note of any questions that you may have during the presentation for the brief question and answer session that will follow. Our subject is entitled, The Fountains of the Great Deep. Read from Job 38, verses 4 through 11. Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding. Who hath laid the measures thereof, if thou knowest? Or who hath stretched the line upon it? Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened? Or who laid the cornerstone thereof? When the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Or who shut up the sea with doors when it brake forth, as if it had issued out of the womb, when I made the cloud the garment thereof, and thick darkness a swaddling band for it, and brake up for it my decreed place, and set bars and doors, and said, Hitherto shalt thou come, but no further, and here shall thy proud waves be stayed. The expressions of this passage from Job are full of meaning for us. We understand the language here to describe the creative processes which prepared the earth for man's habitation. Verse 9 has special significance to our subject. It also reminds us of another important passage of Scripture found in Proverbs 8, verse 28. He established the clouds above. He strengthened the fountains of the deep. A careful study of these verses, together with the Genesis account, reveals to us a consistent picture of creation and the flood. We continue our reading in Genesis 7, verse 11. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened. This verse brings several questions to mind. What is the great deep mentioned here? We answer that this great deep is the same one mentioned in Genesis 8:2. The fountains also of the deep and the windows of heaven were stopped, and the rain from heaven was restrained. This concept is also found in Genesis 1:2. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. Based on suggestions in the harvest message, we believe that the face of the deep is the same as the face of the waters. The words fountain and deep do not accurately convey the sense of the Hebrew in this context. These English words carry with them the sense of direction. Fountains tend to go up. A deep tends to be something beneath us. However, the Genesis account is speaking of the creative processes from a much larger perspective, involving more than just our planet Earth. The terms up and down have no significance in outer space. The word fountain in the Hebrew simply signifies a source of water. The word deep is from Strong's 84:15 in the Hebrew, meaning an abyss in the sense of a surging mass of water. This word is derived from Strong's 1949 in the Hebrew, meaning to make an uproar or to agitate greatly. As we look deeper into the creation account, how appropriate we find the usage of this word to be. It was the power of God moving upon the face of this surging mass of water that initiated the ordering of earth for mankind. Another question remains, where was this great deep? A careful analysis of the facts demonstrates clearly that the only possible place was beyond the atmosphere of the earth. Some have suggested that the fountains of the great deep refer to subterranean chambers filled with water. However, this would have been an impossibility on the first creative day. The earth was initially too hot to support any form of liquid water, neither on the surface nor beneath the surface. This thought is confirmed in the Photodrama of Creation, page 2. Quote, "In the beginning the earth was, without form and void, shapeless, empty. There were neither mountains nor valleys, trees nor shrubs, rivers nor oceans, but the earth was." End of quotation. We read again from the Photodrama of Creation, page 16. Quote, "The fountains of the great deep, canopy, were broken up." End of quotation. This clearly shows that the term great deep refers to the canopy that enveloped the earth, lingering until the days of Noah, when the last remnants of that canopy collapsed upon the earth. The breaking up of the canopy occurred in a very literal way. We understand this was not liquid water, but frozen water. Certain natural forces caused this great ice canopy to be broken up. This process began on the first creative day. Recent scientific discoveries continue to support this scriptural view of creation and the flood. Within the last few decades, a remarkable discovery has been made concerning our solar system. Billions of miles away, far beyond the orbit of Pluto, lies a mysterious object called the Oort cloud. This immense cloud is composed entirely of dirty ice. It is in fact an ice canopy, very similar to the one that originally surrounded the earth. But how did it form? Many theories have been suggested, but scientists must confess that they do not know. Our understanding of the Genesis account suggests a reasonable theory. When the white-hot mass that constituted our solar system was in its infancy, the intense heat and combustion caused huge quantities of water vapor to be expelled into the outer regions beyond the planets. there in the super cold realms of empty space, this water vapor condensed into a huge ice canopy that still exists to this day. The density of this ice is such that it does not prevent our ability to see beyond to other stars and galaxies. The same concept was true before the flood of Noah's day. These ice canopies do not obstruct the view of other heavenly bodies completely. However, they do alter that view. From time to time, external forces cause disruptions in the Oort cloud, sending huge chunks of ice into an elliptical orbit around our sun. This is the source of our long-term comets. We mention this discovery to show that the concept of an ice canopy, as taught in the Harvest Message, is supported by recent scientific discoveries. What surrounded the Earth was very similar, but on a much smaller scale. The ice canopy around Earth would have been only a short distance removed from our upper atmosphere. Another interesting discovery has been made in just the past few years. A phenomenon called blue ice was seen for the first time in recent human history in the late 1880s. This was supposedly caused by a huge volcanic eruption. The incident passed, the clouds dissipated, and no further thought was given to the subject for over 100 years. Scientific research on the International Space Station and recent space shuttle missions, especially in the last 5 years, reveals that clouds of blue ice have begun forming spontaneously over huge regions of the southern hemisphere. These ice clouds exist at altitudes of nearly 60 miles. Global warming is considered the most likely culprit. If the growth of these blue ice clouds should ever expand into the northern hemisphere, it would interfere with the launch of objects into outer space. But more importantly, from our perspective, it may be a recreation of the original ice canopy on a smaller scale. We mention this discovery to show another possible natural mechanism in the formation of ice canopies. Also, the possibility exists that such an ice canopy, coupled with other elements of global warming and other factors, may cause great moderation in Earth's climate, setting the stage for changes that are necessary to the full establishment of the earthly kingdom. Returning to the creation account, we find that there were many layers within this ice canopy that fell in rapid succession. The earlier layers were composed of ice mixed with minerals and rock. These fell onto the hot surface of the Earth. The resulting chemical reactions helped produce our atmosphere. As this process continued, the surface of the Earth cooled, the Earth's crust thickened, surface water became more abundant, and continents emerged and oceans were formed. Genesis chapters 7 and 8 speak about the fountains of the great deep, the windows of heaven, and the rain. All three are different, but all three are related. When we reach Noah's day, the remaining canopy was of pure water only, in the form of ice. This was the sole remnant of the great deep. The windows of heaven were the polar channels through which the broken canopy was deposited in the form of millions of cubic miles of super cold ice. The term window is peculiar and significant. It suggests that a relatively small portal existed through which the fountains of the great deep deposited their contents. The fact that this term is plural supports the thought that both north and south polar regions were involved. The 40 days of rain was caused by the sudden extremes of hot and cold. This condition did not exist prior to the flood. As we read in Genesis 2:5, the Lord God had not caused it to rain upon the earth. From this we understand that the rain did not cause the flood, but was merely incidental to the falling of the ice canopy. This brings us to another aspect of our subject, Noah's Ark. The experience of the Apostle Thomas led to the proverb, seeing is believing. Truly, some things are difficult to comprehend without a visual aid. For that reason, we would like to take advantage of another aspect of the restitution blessings of computers and electronic communication. We are going to travel back to Noah's day and examine the ark during its construction phases. The Bible is not clear as to exactly where Noah built the ark or what the surroundings were like. We have chosen a peaceful seaside setting, though in reality it is more likely that the ark was built further away from water. The fall of the canopy would have created monstrous tidal waves. Being further away from the shore would have reduced the initial impact of the first wave. Since the Bible does not give us much detailed information on the construction of the ark, what we have to offer is based on personal research, careful analysis, and deduction. A series of articles from Bible Study Monthly of England was also very helpful in forming opinions on a number of points. These thoughts are merely suggestions. Our purpose is to demonstrate that such a project was feasible and practical. It matters little if other methods were used. We only wish to show one possible method in order to vindicate the Genesis account and to give an answer to higher critics. With such an immense construction project as this, the first task for Noah and his sons would probably have been the preparation of the site itself. Just as it was necessary to prepare the platform level before the construction of the Great Pyramid could begin, so too we believe the same was done before construction began on Noah's Ark. In fact, we believe that many of the same principles used in constructing the Great Pyramid may very well have been learned by Shem when he was assisting in the construction of the Ark. We will discuss some other connections between the Great Pyramid and Noah's Ark as we proceed through this lesson. To begin the project, a large rectangular area would have been cleared and leveled. It is likely that the base of the ark was built first. Waterproofing material would have been applied to the underside as the floor was constructed. A beveled retaining wall with corner sockets like the Great Pyramid may have been used around the perimeter of the base. This would have served several purposes. Most importantly, it would have relieved stress on the joinings of the sides and base created by the weight of the structure. Incidentally, such stresses would not have existed once the ark was afloat. Such a perimeter wall would have also defined the dimensions of the ark before construction even began, thus providing a useful project boundary. Construction materials would have been gathered, finished, and stored until needed. This phase could have commenced many years or even decades before construction itself began. It is important to remember the conditions that existed before the flood. The entire planet was bathed in tropical warmth due to the hothouse conditions under the canopy. Plant growth was much larger and more uniform than at present. Finding the huge trees necessary for the beams and crossbeams of the ark would have been a much easier task than today. Preservation of the wood itself was of less consequence, since the processes which caused fermentation and other similar forms of decay did not exist before the flood. Just as God instructed Moses in the building of the tabernacle and Shem in the construction of the Great Pyramid, we believe he also instructed Noah in the techniques necessary for constructing the ark. The task of cutting, finishing, transporting, and finally raising huge beams into place would have been a much simpler task than was necessary to construct the Great Pyramid. The use of simple mechanisms such as levers, ropes, pulleys, and ramps would have been adequate for Noah's Ark. The Great Pyramid was most likely constructed during a period of 30 years, between 2170 BC and 2140 BC. The suggestion drawn from Genesis 6:3 that God told Noah to build the ark 120 years before the flood seems like a reasonable inference. However, this would have been before his sons were born. Nevertheless, from other indications, Noah was probably a wealthy and influential man, and may have used his wealth and influence in gathering and preparing materials before Ham, Shem, and Japheth were old enough to assist. The Genesis account suggests that the structure of the ark was nothing like a conventional boat. This is certainly reasonable, since few of the traditional uses of boats apply to the ark. Its main function was to transport cargo, and the most precious cargo at that. No motive power was necessary. No steering mechanism was required. No sleek design was needed to speed the ark through ocean waters. It merely had to drift with the current. All these factors and others prove conclusively that the shape of the ark was that of a huge flat-bottom boat. Furthermore, based on our understanding of all the facts, the shape shown here is the one most in accord with the Bible, with reason, and with scientific principles. The size of the ark is given in Genesis 6:15. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, the breadth of it 50 cubits, and the height of it 30 cubits. There is a great deal of uncertainty in respect to the length of the cubit used. Several measures have been proposed. 18 inches is the size of the modern cubit. The royal cubit of Egypt was between 20.6 and 21.6 inches. The pyramid cubit is roughly 25 inches. Each of these measures has arguments in favor of its use. Using the modern cubit would have resulted in a size of 450 feet long by 45 feet high by 75 feet wide at the base. If the royal cubit of 21.6 inches was used, the size of the ark would have been 540 feet long by 54 feet high by 90 feet wide at the base. The largest dimensions would arise from using the pyramid cubit, 625 feet long by 62.5 feet high by approximately 104 feet wide at the base. Assyrian records show a length for the ark of 540 feet. The smallest of these systems of measurement would still have resulted in a vessel sufficiently large to fulfill its mission. If we use the modern cubit, then the timbers used in constructing this model would correspond to a size of 24 inches by 24 inches. The length of the longest timber would have been 75 feet. As stated before, trees with such dimensions would have been more plentiful in Noah's day than now. There was also the possibility of fabricating larger beams from a series of smaller ones. Two working models of Noah's Ark with the same design shown here have been constructed in the past. The largest, 120 feet long, was constructed in Holland by one Peter Jansen in the year 1609. It was used commercially for a time, but was abandoned due to the difficulty in arranging for motive power. The other was strictly a model, built by a naval architect named Vogt in 1904. It had a length of 30 feet. In both cases, the most remarkable feature of this design was the extreme seaworthiness of the craft, even in the roughest of seas. We are standing on the deck of the middle floor of Noah's Ark. From here, we can begin to see and appreciate the immense size and capacity of this vessel. Behind me, nearly two football fields distant, almost 600 feet away, is the other end of the ark. The height from floor to ceiling here is over 16 feet, and the distance from one edge of the floor to the other at this level was 60 feet. This would provide a square foot capacity of over 30,000. But that does not begin to tell the story, because items could have been stored in a stacked fashion from floor to ceiling, providing an immense cubic capacity. This area, we believe, was used as a storage place for food and other necessaries that would be required during the journey. Once the outer surface of the ark was in place, this area would have been in total darkness. When Noah and his sons made their daily journeys here to take items to the top floor, some form of artificial illumination would have been necessary, such as torches or other things. For that reason, we believe that animals and humans did not reside in this part of the ark. We believe that only the top floor was suitable as living quarters. A system of ramps or stairs would have been necessary to give access between floors during the journey. We're still standing on the second or middle floor of the ark. What we'll be looking at is given merely in the way of a suggestion, but some similar concept would have been necessary. This longer ramp is less steep and would have been more practical for regular use. It joins this second floor to the top and would have been used by Noah and his sons on a daily basis to carry food and other materials from here up to the top floor. These shorter ramps are more steep. They join this second middle floor to the bottom. These would not have been used on a regular basis. They would have only been used in case of an emergency. We will be visiting the top and the bottom floors in a few minutes, but before we do, there is one other feature we would like to look at here on the second floor. Creating a model of Noah's Ark was an educational experience in many ways. It required careful thought as to some of the practical issues that would have been faced by Noah and his family. One of those issues is addressed in the next section. It is presented merely in the way of a suggestion for your consideration. We are at one of the two extreme ends of the ark, looking down into this large rectangular tank-like area. Each of these had a capacity of 72,000 gallons. The two at this end, a combined capacity of 144,000 gallons, and likewise at the other end, two tanks. What was their purpose? We believe that there had to be some means for storing fresh water and also
waste materials during the journey. It's important to remember that there was virtually no access to the outside world during the journey.
There is a rather obscure phrase in Genesis 6:16, "In a cubit shalt thou finish it above." The cuneiform sign for cubit and the primitive pictograph which preceded it in the days of Eber and Peleg suggests an angle. And this expression, "finished in a cubit above," might well denote what we call the apex, the angle at the top of the arc formed by the meeting of the two sloping sides. Much as we might say it finished in an inverted V at the top. It was at this apex of the roof that a small aperture existed to allow fresh air to enter and to circulate. These and all openings of the ark were sealed when it was overwhelmed by the first wave.
We're now on the bottom floor of the ark, and you'll notice behind me there's one of the short steep ramps that goes up to the second level. As mentioned before, this would not have been used only rarely during the journey, but it might have been much more useful during the construction phases and during the period when materials were being loaded upon the ark. It's important to remember that the purpose of this lowest level was a kind of a warehouse to store materials that would have been used primarily after the flood, after the ark landed on the mountains of Ararat. We believe that those materials could have been placed here a long time before the flood. In fact, it would have been most practical if they could have been brought in before the outer surface of the ark was actually put in place. There is a sort of a pathway that you'll notice here in front of us, and this pathway would have been useful to use large wheeled carts for moving materials from the outside as they came in and then to take them to their respective locations. It is a massive area here, over 50,000 square feet, and we'll be looking at it more here in just a moment. This particular view of the bottom floor of the ark is looking in from the side, the longest dimension being to my left and right, a distance of over 500 feet, nearly 2 football fields in length. But the distance across the floor here from edge to edge was also immense, 90 feet. It's by taking these dimensions that we come up with the figure of more than 50,000 square feet of floor space. But it is important to remember that materials could have been stacked from floor to ceiling, a distance of more than 16 feet, thus providing a huge area for cargo. These materials were items that were being stored for use primarily after the ark landed on the mountains of Ararat. You'll notice behind me is the pathway we referred to earlier that could have been used by the large wheeled carts to move materials into place. Also in front of me on the floor, you'll notice there is kind of a ribbed effect here. These beams would have served at least two purposes. One of them would have been to reinforce the structure of the ark itself, but the other purpose would have been to help to keep materials in place during rough seas. Crates or some other form of box could have been constructed by Noah and his sons in which to place materials, and they could have been so constructed as to fit neatly into these areas, and thus perhaps even interlocking would have been very rigid during transit. We are still on the bottom floor of the ark at one of the two ends. And you'll notice the wall here that is next to me. This wall is a sort of a bulkhead arrangement. It is formed by one of the walls of the four large tanks that we looked at earlier. We're actually going to go inside one of these tanks and look at it in a few moments. The tanks at the end would have provided a sort of structural support, and it was the ends where structural support was most needed. But also materials could have been stacked against these walls here on the bottom floor. We're now inside one of the four large tanks that we referred to earlier. The only way of getting in and out of here right now is this ladder behind me. Of course, once the ark was completed
and before the journey began, we think that two of these tanks were probably filled with fresh water for drinking, and the other two tanks were used for disposing of waste material during the journey. This large pillar on my right is an example of one of the largest beams that would have been necessary for the structure of the ark. And depending on which dimensions of the ark we choose, this beam would have been 24 inches by 24 inches, or it could have been as much as 30 inches by 30 inches, depending on what size of the cubit that we use. We are now on the top or third floor of Noah's ark. Though this was the smallest in area, it is by far the most important. It is here that Noah, his family, and all of the animals resided for a period of approximately 1 year. Though it is the smallest of the three, it is still a very large area. The distance from side to side here is 30 feet across the floor, and likewise from end to end, over 500 feet, even at this level. Thus, the number of square feet of floor space was over 15,000. But it is the cubic capacity which is most significant. With a height from floor to ceiling of over 16 feet, the cubic capacity would have been more than 120,000. And we believe that this would have been sufficient for living quarters for Noah, his family, and all of the animals. In this section of the ark, we have some examples of smaller living quarters that would have been more common for the varieties of air-breathing animals found on the ark. We'd like to thank our assistants here today, both of them. It's important to remember that the average size of an adult air-breathing animal is that of a common house cat. The Genesis account does not give many details on how the animal's living spaces were constructed. So what we have to offer here again is merely in the way of a suggestion. It's important to remember that there were very few large animals such as horses or cows on Noah's Ark. And for those that were larger, it is possible, likely, that a traditional arrangement was constructed, such as what we see here. It is estimated that all living varieties of breathing animals sprang from approximately 25,000 different species. If we make a liberal estimate of both the clean and the unclean animals that were on board the ark, the total number of animals would have been something more than 50,000 and something less than 60,000. For sake of argument, let's assume the higher number of 60,000. Taking that with the estimated cubic capacity of this section of the ark of 120,000 cubic feet, this would have provided an average living space for each of the animals of 2 cubic feet. We read in Genesis 6:14, "Make thee an ark of gopher wood. Rooms shalt thou make in the ark, and shalt pitch it within and without with pitch." The word translated rooms here really means nests in the Hebrew. The height of this section would have allowed for many nests or other compartments for the animals stacked from floor to ceiling. The size of the compartment shown here is about 2 cubic feet. This was chosen for illustrative purposes, since it is the average amount of living space that would have been available for each animal. The house cat shown here is the size of an average air-breathing animal. The amount of space allotted seems quite adequate. In addition, if the animals taken on board the ark were not mature adults, then the average size would have been even smaller. One other factor is worthy of consideration in respect to the animals. Many animals go into a state of hibernation in the wintertime. Other species have been known to go into a similar state of relative dormancy under severe circumstances. Since darkness would have been the normal condition, even on the top floor, it is possible that many, if not all the animals, went into such a state of suspended animation. This would have solved many logistical problems. It would have significantly reduced the demands on 8 people to feed 60,000 animals and to dispose of their waste. It would also have reduced the amount of food and water necessary on board. Regardless of what methods the Lord chose, the main point of our analysis and conclusions is that such a project was both possible and practical. Several comments have been made about the need for structural support and integrity in the construction of the ark. It was mentioned that the 4 tanks at opposite ends of the ark provide much needed support. Other comments have been made concerning the huge beams used throughout the framework. From an architectural standpoint, the strongest geometric shape used in construction is the triangle. The strongest three-dimensional shape used in construction is that of the pyramid. For example, a common gabled roof is in the shape of a pyramid. This shape is evident in our model of Noah's Ark as well. The need for structural support was especially important when the floodwaters initially overwhelmed the ark. As mentioned before, the waters of the canopy descended at the poles and rushed toward the equator in the form of huge tidal waves. When these waves first reached the ark, the initial impact was tremendous. A conventional boat would not have survived. A flat-bottom boat in the shape of a large box would also not have survived such an impact. It is only the pyramid shape, as shown in this model, that is suited for all the circumstances related to us in the Bible and in the harvest message. We are reminded of 2 important passages of Scripture. And God said, "Let there be a firmament," atmosphere, "in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters." And God made the firmament, and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. Genesis 1, 6 and 7. By the intention of God, the skies existed from of old, and the earth with water above and water below, arranged for the purpose of God, by means of which the then existing world perished, by the water having rushed down. 2 Peter 3, 5 and 6, for R. Fenton's translation.
Noah was a man of faith, and he believed God and acted out that belief in carrying out a command that must have seemed utterly fantastic to all who heard of it. And the greatest test of faith must have been at the moment when, with all his 20,000 tons of stores and goods and animals stowed safely inside, Noah and his family climbed into the giant vessel which they had built. They heard the door close heavily upon them and shut them away completely from the outside world and sat down in the darkness to wait. Noah and his family sat inside the ark, counting 7 slow days from the 10th day of the 2nd month until the 17th day, waiting for the fulfillment of God's word and the coming of divine judgment. So our thoughts come back to those 8 persons of faith, the only ones in all the world who believed God, shut up inside the only possible haven of refuge from the wrath to come, surrounded by a heedless and scornful world which went on with its daily interests, unbelieving, ignorant. And far to the south of that land, with its shining cities, away at the other end of the southern ocean, which they had probably never even explored, there rushed towards them the angel of vengeance, which was to sweep their land with the besom of destruction and leave God's world ready for a fresh start.
The story of creation and the flood inspired millions of people all over the world in the days of Brother Russell. This story continues to inspire us today. The questions we must ask ourselves are, why does it inspire us? What is the true value for us in investigating this subject? What is its value when speaking about it to others? What is our responsibility toward the truth? We have examined the creative processes, including certain details which were not available in Brother Russell's day. The truth, as presented in the photodrama of creation and other writings of the pastor, have stood the test of time. With each passing year, with each passing decade, yea, even with the passing of a century, the truth stands out more brilliant than before. Time has not been its enemy, but rather its greatest proponent. We stand in awe at its matchless beauty and grandeur. Such is part of the inspiration we gain from studying this and all aspects of the truth. We have much to gain from such a study. Foremost is the bolstering of our faith. This forms a part of our putting on the whole armor of God, not only the shield of faith which protects our hearts, but also the helmet of salvation which protects our minds. Brother Russell foretold, and that accurately, that evolution and higher criticism would increase more and more, invading even the bastions of so-called Christianity. By the Lord's grace and provision, we have a reason for the hope that is within us. We have the truth which protects us against such attacks of the enemy. Even in those details which are merely speculation, we find a value. We cannot present such opinions as fact, but we can present such ideas as possible answers to critics of the truth. We are able to answer those who insist that the Bible is out of harmony with science, for we understand the true science of the Bible. We cannot know the many details alluded to in this presentation, but we do know the concept behind those suggestions. It is this package of the truth that gives us assurance that what we believe is not cunningly devised fables. Such assurance gives us confidence when speaking to others, not confidence in ourselves, but confidence in the complete harmony of the truth and God its author. We can assist those who are falling into infidelity due to conflicting and unreasonable creeds. We can assist those who have honest questions about the Bible. We can help them to see God's invitation to all truth-seekers, "Come, let us reason together." Such confidence in the truth gives a force and shade of meaning to our words that carries with it a power far superior to anything we or any other human being can possess. Possession of such a priceless gift carries with it a grand privilege and a serious responsibility. Truth is not merely for our own satisfaction, but is given for a purpose. The greatest purpose we have at present is to defend the character of God. The truth is God's representative, and we in turn are representatives of God, ambassadors for Christ, and are privileged to tell forth the glad tidings to others. We have a divine commission to tell them. Lift up the light. Lift up a standard for the people.
Thank you.
A vindication of the divine character and government, showing by recognition and harmonizing of all the scriptures that the permission of evil past and present is educational and preparatory to the ushering of mankind into the golden age of prophecy, in which all the families of the earth will be blessed with the full knowledge of God and a full opportunity for attaining everlasting life through the Redeemer, who then will be the great restorer and life giver, Acts 3:19-21, the purpose of the plan of the ages as published for us. And how wonderful it is to know these truths. Now we're going to be having a question and answer session. Brother Darren Henke will be handling the microphone. I'll explain a little bit how this will work. We will take questions from the audience. During any pauses, if there's questions from the online brethren, we will want to take those. Brother Alan Springer will answer those questions, and you'll hear his voice from Szeged, Romania.
1, 2, 3. Dear brethren, it is indeed a great joy to be with you in this very special way, as we said at the beginning. And even more special to be able to speak to you live from Szeged, Romania. We want to repeat the message of love, and especially from the brethren who were assembled here today in convention. We had our own convention here today. What a blessing to be able to attend two conventions the same weekend. We thank the Lord for these blessings and privileges. Back to you. Over.
Thank you, Brother Alan. And please give this convention's love to the brethren there. Okay. We're ready? All right, so we're ready for our first questions. Okay, Brother Robbie has a question. Brother Robbie Long.
Hello, Brother Alan, can you hear me?
Yeah, he can
yes,
hear
okay,
you.
Okay. I understand you have to go through some switches to get his voice. Brother Alan, your presentation was very impressive, both the commentary and the visual aids, and I think I could safe to say that everybody here thoroughly enjoyed it. And I know that must have taken some time, so my question is actually a little bit of a technical question. If you wouldn't mind giving us a brief synopsis on how you created that, and also would we be able to obtain a copy of it on DVD? And thank you very much for that labor. It was very enjoyable. Over to you, Brother Alan.
One, two, three. Okay, we're going to go ahead and give a real brief answer to that. There is a link which Brother Bilvitsky has for brethren who can see some of this online. The text is available on a website. The DVD is available for copy. We hadn't anticipated that, but the brethren there do have the DVD, and I assume that they might be in a position to copy it. I don't want to volunteer their services, but if that's not possible, we can make other arrangements. As far as how it was done, we can discuss that with you through email, but we'll just give a real brief comment that it was done with Adobe Premiere. Back to you.
Thank you, Brother Alan. And yes, the brethren will be making copies for those who desire it. Any other questions? Yes, Sister Garrison, Judy.
Brother Alan, this is Sister Judy Garrison from. Brother Alan, this is Sister Judy Garrison from Salem, Oregon, and my question was then, because I didn't take notes fast enough. Were all the animals and all the people on the top story of the building and the middle story and lower level were used then for cargo and things that they would need after the flood?
I'm going to go ahead and answer without pausing here. We hope it comes through all right, but that is our understanding. Of course, we can't prove anything from the little amount of information that's given to us in the Genesis account. We can only use logic. We do have some hints in the Genesis account. But yes, we believe that it was only the top floor that where there could possibly have been animals and Noah and his family. The middle bottom floors were used for materials. Back to you.
Brother David and then Brother Lou.
Brother Allen, this is Brother Dave Kirkham. Nice to hear your voice. I just wonder if you have any additional thoughts on Genesis chapter 6, verses 11 to 13, where it refers to the earth being corrupt and the earth filled with violence, and that the purpose of the flood was to kill the flesh upon the earth that was filling the earth with violence. And the same word is used again in Genesis 11, 1, just prior to the Tower of Babel incident. And it says, and the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. I've heard some suggest that earth here might mean the civilized world at that time. So would you please give me a summary of your thoughts on whether you believe the flood covered the entire face of the earth and that, in fact, there was a literal destruction of all flesh, both human and otherwise. Over.
Okay. That is a common question. I have to tell you, brethren, that there's a rather unusual thing going outside right now. This is a special weekend here, and they're having fireworks, and I think they're right outside my window. So if you hear some explosions in the background, that's what that noise is. It's a little distracting. But there is a different opinions on whether the flood was universal. I feel very strongly that the flood was universal, and especially when we consider the tidal wave concept, we believe that those tidal waves were large enough that they would have swept over the tallest of the mountains. It may have only been for a short period of time that they swept over those mountains, but it would have been enough to kill all of the creatures that were air-breathing at the time. This is our opinion, of course, but we feel that the evidence supports such a thought. Over.
Brother Lou.
Brother Allen, Brother Lou Garrison, I have two questions for you. The first question is my understanding that you don't believe that there was rain, it was just a tidal wave, or is it a combination of both? That's the first question. And if the scriptures in 7:12 explains that there was rain 40 days, so is there a combination of both? Is that what your thought is? Over.
Okay, I believe that there was both rain and tidal waves. Our point in the discourse was to say that the rain didn't cause the flood. There was indeed 40 days and 40 nights of rain. That's very clear from the account. But it wasn't the rain that caused the increase in the ocean levels. Geology supports the thought that the levels of the oceans were increased around 450 feet. And we believe that was caused by the flood. It would be impossible for that to have been caused by rain, even if it rained 40 days and 40 nights. That rain was incidental to the flood, but it did exist. Over.
Okay, and Brother Ed Bush. Oh, we got a follow-up question, and then Brother Ed Bush.
Just a second question, and I think you mentioned that there was no decay in the earth before the flood. Could you explain that in the fact that... without decay, human bodies and so forth would not decay and so forth.
Well, we know from the hint that we have concerning Noah after the flood, you remember the incident with the grape juice that turned to wine, and that did not exist prior to the flood is the inference we draw from that. Brother Russell makes that argument, and we think that it's a good argument. So if there was no fermentation, we think that there was also no similar forms of decay that existed. To what extent that was true, we really don't know. But we think that that it would have involved not only fermentation but also other forms of decay. I personally believe, to answer maybe part of the question that wasn't specifically asked, I personally believe that animals, dead animals, were dealt with by scavengers. I think there's evidence that scavengers did exist. I personally don't believe that animals ate other animals alive, but only ate them after they were dead, and this was a part of... Over.
Okay. Brother Ed Bushless is next, and then Sister Karen Long.
Brother Allen, this is Brother Ed Bushless. I thoroughly enjoyed your presentation, and it brought a couple of points to mind I would like to have your thoughts on. One, with the large mass of boards and many numerous boards, what type of fasteners were used to hold them together? Was it a peg type arrangement or tongue and groove? Did they have something like a nail? Or what would stand the force of the tidal waves that would hold this together? And secondly, with the visual of the tidal wave striking the ark, it almost appeared to what we saw as a tsunami recently. What would keep that ark in a triangle shape from rolling over with that type of force? Over.
Okay, I'm glad you asked that question because it answers one of the questions that was asked online. Okay, first of all, I'm sorry, I got a little distracted here because someone is actually knocking on my door. I'm sorry, brother. I'm going to answer the last question first. We believe that the ark would have been struck end on. You might have noticed that in the visual. We think that the Lord would have arranged for Noah to have constructed the ark so that it was oriented north and south, so that when the tidal wave struck it, it would have struck it end on, and this would have kept the ark from rolling over. The sheer force of the water landing on top of the ark would have kept it down until the wave was passed. Then the air inside the ark would have caused it to rise to the surface. We want to thank Brother Jordan Gray. He gave us some assistance when we were in the process of building the model, which was a few years back, and he was in architectural school at the time. We thought about a number of different possibilities, and we would like to suggest that the joinings on the ark were made with wooden pegs of some sort, and also tongue and groove, perhaps a combination of those two. And we think that that would have been perhaps the best arrangement under the circumstances. Back to you.
Now Sister Karen Long has a question, and then Sister...
Greetings, Brother Allen. This is Sister Karen Long, and our question is in reference to Genesis 7:10, with Noah and his family and the animals being in the ark for 7 days prior to the onset of the rain and flood, and wondering if there were any pictures that could be drawn with those 7 days. Over.
Sorry, I have to ask you to repeat the question. I had to go to the door because they were making so much noise it was distracting me. I've taken care of that now. I'm sorry, brethren. Could you please repeat the question?
No problem. Brother Allen, this is Sister Karen Long, and my question was in reference to Genesis 7:10, and Noah and his family and the animals being in the ark for 7 days prior to the onset of the rain and the wave, and wondering if there were any pictures that can be drawn to that period of 7 days. Over.
Okay. I have to admit that I didn't really study that portion. I remember in reading the Bible study monthly account, I think Brother Hudson was the one who wrote that. I don't remember. And he had some suggestions on that. So brother who might have those, I would refer them to that. We could only speculate as far as the 7 days. Certainly it's a complete number. We think that there may be some prophetic significance to the entire scenario, which we didn't touch upon in this presentation. And I'm sorry that off the top of my head, I really can't give a good answer to that.
Okay, we have several questions. Sister Carol Long, Brother Peter Kirkham, and then Brother Jerry Leslie.
Brother Alan, this
Over.
Is Brother Alan, this is Sister Carol Long. I had a question. Did you allude to the fact that most of the animals were in baby form, were baby animals, and or hibernation?
Yes. Once again, anything that we presented in detail would be only a suggestion. And these were things that had to be considered when you think of the sheer logistics of what was involved with that many animals. And it seemed reasonable that with the conditions on the ark, that the animals that were selected, not necessarily babies, but younger forms of those animals, so that they would have been smaller on the average size. And also, we have done some research on the internet where others outside of our fellowship suggest the same concept, that perhaps there was hibernation by many of the animals, if not all of the animals. Over.
Okay, Brother Peter, and then Brother Jerry.
Hi, Brother Alan. This is Brother Peter Kirkham. And I like your idea that it's a triangular shape. And, of course, if you have the tanks, too, you have, if you can do a lower center of gravity in that shape, it becomes very stable. So if the food stores and the water and so forth were put in the tanks, it would help the stabilization. But my question is on Genesis chapter 7. And verses 19 and 20, with the 15 cubits upward did the waters prevail. And I'd like to get your thoughts and interpretation on what that means in the 19th and 20th verse. Of course, those translation of that word can be mountains or hills. And I just wanted your thoughts of whether that would be the highest mountain, and also the maybe if you have some thoughts on the effect of this flood on the earth's crust. So those are my questions. Over.
Okay, once again, we're glad to have that question asked. There's only so much can be covered in an hour's time. We believe that the reference to 15 cubits there is not referring to the depths of the water on the earth. We believe that that 15 cubits in the context, the overall context, is talking how high the water was on the side of the ark. We think this is the only thing that makes logical sense from the context. The ark was 30 cubits high. If the water came up 15 cubits, that would be exactly half of the height of the ark. From this, we could even do a very accurate calculation of what the lading of the ark was, how much cargo was on board. And again, some of these details are covered in the numerous articles that were published in Bible Study Monthly. So again, our suggestion here is that that 15 cubits has a reference to how high the water was on the side of the ark. It's scientifically verifiable, and also it would validate the concept that the animals were only on the top floor, because only on the top floor would you have had windows that could have provided for fresh air. If I failed to answer part of that question, please ask again. Over.
Did he cover that? Oh, the earth crust? About the earth's crust? Is that was it? Go ahead and repeat your question, Brother Peter.
Yeah, the second part of it was then your thoughts on the volume of water from the flood and their possible effects on the earth crust, and whether that would have pushed mountains upward and what effects it would have had.
Okay, very good. Thank you. If you're really mathematically inclined, you can do a calculation here. If you follow the standard formula for calculating the volume of a sphere, and if you calculate an increase in ocean levels of 450 feet, and if you assume that that is over 70% of the surface of the Earth, that would give you 12 million cubic miles of water. 12 million cubic miles. That is an incredible sum that I don't think we can even fathom. If you take a lower estimate of only 300 feet rise, that would be 8 million cubic miles. That's a lot of water. And Brother also suggests in the photodrama that each time there were deluges, the one of Noah's day was the last of many, each time there were deluges that it would have affected the Earth's crust, would have buckled the crust, would have caused certain areas to go higher, certain areas to go lower. And there is definite evidence, and some of this is given in the volume 6 chapter on the creative account. So we think that, yes, it did have an effect on the Earth's crust. Over.
Brother Jerry Leslie.
Brother Alan, this is Brother Jerry, and I found many of your explanations very compelling, particularly the relationship between Noah, Shem, and the Great Pyramid, and the engineering skills that were acquired here, as well as the shape of the ark. Perhaps something that Brother Peter just said is very persuasive. The idea of ballast and the broader base and a tidal wave overflowing it would not really tip it over, unlike ships that are built with a narrower base and a wider top. When you referenced Genesis 6:16, I found a couple of other translations that confirmed what you said. One said, finish it upwards to a cubit. And so it suggests an upward narrowing to a single cubit at the peak. I may have missed it, but I'd like to ask, were you suggesting that the angles of the ark conform to the angles of the Great Pyramid? And I think that just essentially my question is, and in your model, did it follow the angles of the Great Pyramid? Over to you, Brother Alan.
1, 2, 3. Okay, for the sake of those that are not aware, the pictures of the ark were from a model that was built about 4 years ago, and that's still in the United States at the home of Brother Laddie and Sister Debbie Stewart. And the model that we built, we saw at the very beginning that the proportions were very similar to the Great Pyramid. So when we built the model, we built it with the angle of 51 degrees, 51 minutes. And it only required a slight adjustment. And it's interesting that if you increase the height by that cubit that you were mentioning, Brother Jerry, and then you allow for the thickness of wood and so on, if that is a reference to that, it's maybe stretching it a little bit, but it would make the proportions exactly the same as the Great Pyramid. It's kind of an attractive thought to my mind, but it is, again, over.
I assume that last word was just a suggestion. Brother Lawrence, up here in front.
Good morning, Alan. I like your comments on how the continental shelves fit into your scenario. Over.
One, two, three. Well, I know there's different theories on that. And as I understand it, there are seven major divisions within the tectonic plates, seven regions. And this may be a reference to the scriptural concept of the seven pillars upon which the earth rests. So we know scientifically and from the Bible that there is support to this idea of the tectonic plates and the earth's crust being divided in this way. I don't know how much of continental drift was affected by the various deluges. But certainly it would have been a process that would have taken place, I believe, throughout the first six creative days. And, of course, into the seventh, ending with the Noah's flood. So continental drift does seem to be a reasonable concept, and we have evidence of that, but I don't think that it all took place at the time of the flood. There are some people who believe that, and again, it's my opinion, but I think that the evidence and the thoughts presented in the photodrama show more of a gradual drifting of the continents during the period of 43,656 years. Over.
Okay, we have another question from Sister Judy.
Hi, Brother Alan. This is Sister Judy Garrison again. It's been a while since I studied it, but I thought that the pastor made the presentation that the Garden of Eden effect on the earth would be the result of the falling of another ring around the earth, perhaps an electrical ring or something like that. Was it your presentation in this presentation, did you bring forth the thought that perhaps another ice ring is going to be forming around the earth, or did I misunderstand that, and that your theory would be then that this ice ring around the earth would even out the temperature of the earth and would cause another condition similar to that of the Garden of Eden? Over.
Okay, two different concepts there. Again, very good questions here. There are two different points that Brother Russell makes in the photodrama, and we only addressed one of those in the presentation. The evening out of temperatures is one thing, and we think that perhaps the rebuilding of an ice canopy with these blue ice clouds is a possibility. We don't know. But there's another place in the photodrama where Brother Russell talks about another ring that might fall and bring an end to disease and fermentation and decay, such as it was before the flood. That's a different concept. And it's very interesting, another very interesting point where the harvest message was well in advance of modern science. There is something called the Van Allen belts. And essentially, they are an electrical ring which surrounds the Earth. These were discovered in 1958 when the first satellites went up into outer space. Brother Russell wrote about it with the photodrama many decades before. We don't know whether these belts will have anything to do with what Brother Russell suggested. Time will tell. But again, the point is these are two separate concepts. The falling of the electrical ring is totally separate from the ice canopy, which kept the temperatures moderate, and that some kind of global warming, including blue ice clouds, which may moderate temperatures in the future. Over.
Okay, very good. Any other questions? Follow up, Sister Judy?
So, this is Brett. So, Brother Alan, then this is a follow-up on that. Is your thought then that both may be true, that there may be this electrical canopy that would fall that would maybe then take care of disease and so forth, and then that the ice canopy forming would even out the temperatures? Could both of these things happen? Over.
1, 2, 3. Well, yes, we have definite evidence of both of them. There's no question that there is an electrical ring which surrounds the Earth. That's a proven scientific fact. Whether it will fall or not remains to be seen. And the rebuilding of the ice canopy, that may or may not be what causes the moderation in Earth's temperature. Global warming is also a scientifically proven fact. We can no longer deny it. The changes in climate and temperature and in the polar ice caps has been dramatic and a rapid increase just in the last decade. Over.
Okay, Brother Peter has a question.
Brother Alan, Brother Peter again. Since they're bringing up the electrical thing, I saw an interesting show a while back. It was about the magnetic poles shifting, and that they had scientific proof from sediments and so forth that the poles had shifted in the past from north to south. And they had a timing on how long this had taken and so forth from this. And so I just wondered if you had any thoughts about that. The one thing that I noted from that was that if the poles did shift, it created a period of radiation and lack of protection from radiation, and that it seemed to kind of fit into the picture of you know, not having children again and so forth. The other effect that was kind of interesting was that we're familiar with the northern lights and the aurora borealis, and if the poles shifted during this period of the shift, these lights would occur across the sky around the world. And so it was this kind of interesting, and I wondered if you had any thoughts on it. I know it's purely speculative.
One, two, three. Okay. Well, it's not entirely speculative. As far as the reversal of Earth's magnetic field, we know that that is going to happen. It's only a matter of time, and scientists are thinking that it could be sooner rather than later. They don't really know what that will cause. And by the way, you asked this question at the same time somebody online asked the same question, but of course it's related to the Van Allen belts indirectly. We don't know if that reversal of the magnetic field will affect those Van Allen belts. Scientists don't know either, so it is purely speculation. But the important point here seems to be that we have enough hints, enough scientific evidence that is in harmony with our understanding of what the harvest message brings out, that this is a bolster to our faith. And this is really the primary thing that we're interested in sharing with one another. What exactly is going to happen? Well, we'll just have to wait and see. But the point is, we see some signposts, we see some indicators, we see some things that are happening that are related to what Brother Russell expected almost 100 years ago. Over.
So we have any additional questions online? That covered that question as well. Well, we're reaching the end of our question and answer period. Brother Allen, did you have any final remarks you would like to make?
One, two, three. Well, again, we want to thank the Lord, first of all. We want to thank the brethren there, and we want to thank everybody that asked questions, because it's an important part of a subject that is this technical in nature. There's so many things that can't be brought out, and we're glad that the brethren were very attentive. And we also rejoice very much that the primary purpose, seems to have been accomplished, and that is to stir up the minds of the brethren to think about these things that were asked in the questions, and to be looking for the fulfillment of these things. And again, the main purpose, the main focus here was to bolster our faith, to help us to appreciate how far ahead of the times Brother Russell was in his presentation, and how all of those things which he expected, not only in relation to creation, but in every aspect of the harvest message, we see evidences that that program is following right along according to expectations as far as the events. Maybe not according to the amount of time that it's taking. But brethren, we can have full confidence that the harvest message is correct and that the harvest messenger was correct. Just one added little point. We would like to say that this subject was also a very fruitful public witness tool. The few times that we were able to use it before we moved to Romania, that it did attract a lot of attention. And so it is also a subject that might be a fruitful area for brethren to be considering. So once again, we thank the Lord and the brethren there, and very grateful that we were able to have this time together. Over.
Thank you, Brother Allen. I think I speak for all the convention and the brethren here who appreciate all the effort and work that went into such a presentation and the studies, and I think we see a show of hands of appreciation here in the room, which is unanimous. So thank you for that. Brother Allen has asked for a closing hymn of 365. I understand it's How Great Thou Art. Now, not all the books may have those, so we might have to share. But it's How Great Thou Art. 358 in the blue book. Does everybody, can everybody see? Is it in that gray book too? So it's 358 in the gray book also. Anybody need a book? We got an extra here.
Soul, my loving God, to thee.
Now I'll ask Brother Allen if he'll close this service in prayer.
One, two, three. Dear gracious, merciful, loving Father in heaven, we humbly and reverently bow before thee. We hallow thy name. We desire to glorify thy name. We desire to uphold thy truth and to be a blessing and a help one to another. And dear Father, have found faithful to be used of thee in uplifting this poor groaning creation. We thank thee for the privilege of knowing something about thy grand and wonderful creation, the works of thy fingers, the sun and the moon and the stars, and all this wonderful universe working together in such grand harmony. We thank thee for the privilege of looking somewhat into these things and looking behind the scenes a little bit. We ask that you would guide our thoughts aright and that you would help us to be inspired by these things, to be more faithful, to take heart in the fact that the harvest message has provided us with such wonderful food in this time in which it is so necessary. We thank thee for that means. We thank thee especially for the gift of thy Son, Jesus, that makes all things possible. Continue to be with us and thy children throughout the earth. And we ask it always in the precious and worthy name of Jesus. Amen.